I just wanted to find a place where the expertise that I do have could be shared. And Uganda was very simple. It was the very first teaching opportunity that I found, someone that was looking for someone with my background to come and teach pathology. So yes, Uganda happened by chance, but I stayed because I am inspired by those doctors, and it's been an honor that they've wanted me to keep coming back. And so as long as they'll have me, I'll keep going. And we have a lot of projects going on that feel really, really cool to be a part of.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's run.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show. We have a special one today. My partner, Nicole Baker, joins us again for the first time since, I want to say, August 2020. I actually nag her about coming on the show as a guest fairly frequently, and she's requested by listeners pretty often as well. But she's one of the most humble people I know and prefers to be a facilitator and kind of behind the curtain and elevating other people. But she just got back from her annual trip to Uganda, and the timing was really good to just kind of get a download on what this year's trip looked like. And for those of you that are not familiar with what she does, a bit of a recap of the last 8 years of work in Equatorial Africa, why she's gone back to school, and how it all works together with her bike riding and her own sponsorships and athletic background. I think you'll really enjoy this one. It's pretty long. It's dense. We cover a lot, but I think you'll find it very inspiring. We recorded it today from Ledger Bentonville, which is the beautiful new workspace, kind of, I don't even really know what to call it. It's an all-encompassing workspace. There are really sweet brands that now call it home. And we're very fortunate in that they have a state-of-the-art podcast studio that we now have access to. And along with recording this, our first episode here, have really been enjoying working in their shared workspaces, and can't thank them enough for welcoming us in. Lastly, I want to say a big thank you to Dometic for supporting today's episode. We have a new discount code for you this year. It's PAYSON15 for 15% off site-wide. So whether you need new drinkware or camp chairs or rooftop tents, powered coolers, portable lithium batteries, portable solar panels, whatever you may need for your spring and summer adventures, you can go to Dometic.com, Dometic.com. Use code PAYSON15 for 15% off. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you after the show. Okay, Nico, we're here in the beautiful Ledger building in Bentonville, Arkansas. You got back from Uganda just under a week ago. And after several years of nagging, pestering, I'm not sure what word you would use.
Pester is good.
Pestering you about coming on the podcast again to talk about your work in Uganda, Path of Logic, and just updating everyone since we talked about it last in, I think it was August or September of 2020. You finally said yes. And I'm really excited about that. But before we really start rolling, I'd like to acknowledge that this is really challenging for both of us, because it's super weird to pretend to be doing just any other podcast when it's not any other podcast. Obviously, we know each other so well, and trying to let the listeners into that in a way that makes sense is a little weird. But you have a lot of stuff going on that is really, really cool, and people want to know more about it. So I'm really glad that we're doing this again.
Yeah, I think this will be fun.
I first interviewed you in August of 2020, just well, I guess it would have been 6 or 7 months after we started dating. Middle of the pandemic still. If people want some added context about what we're talking about today, that includes some of your life story and all that sort of thing, they can go back and listen to those. But if you do, know that those were the early days of the podcast and also the early days of our relationship. So they might sound significantly different. I hope we've come a long way in both regards. I think as a starting point, we should give a little update as to our lives right now. I think folks that follow us are probably confused about how we're always bouncing around different places. We call different places home at this point. And I think along with clarifying some of your work in Uganda and providing more insight into that, I think we should kind of clarify our lives in a way too.
Yeah, and basically how we're able to do everything that we're doing right now, because when we recorded the first podcast, I was still working full time. Like, so much has happened since then. Basically, my work schedule had changed completely. I'd gone from full time to part time, and then I made the big decision to go to grad school based on my experiences that I was having in Uganda and wanting to be better equipped to handle those things. So I started grad school about 2 years ago, and I'm actually just wrapping up. Wrapping up
the master's component.
Yeah,
Not wrapping up for good.
Not wrapping up for good, but this master's in public health program is wrapping up. And kind of making that decision to go back to school pushed me a little bit into the mindset of focusing entirely on pathologic in school. So I left my job, and that's given us a bunch of flexibility to kind of, you know, for me to work remotely from wherever you are. And that's how our lives look as chaotic. Well, that's why they are so chaotic.
Yeah. Obviously, a component of that, too, was I rely on you hugely for my racing career and the podcast and everything else. And it just, there were way too many irons in the fire. Like, there was no way we could pull it all off. And still, a lot of times it feels like there's too many irons in the fire, but it's a lot better than it used to be. Would you agree?
Well, I feel like we make more space and then the irons.
And then fill it. They get added. We'll find new irons. Okay, so just quickly, in regards to home, where we are, why it seems like we're always traveling. We are kind of always traveling, but one change we tried to make, and I think I would like for you to kind of explain what this looks like, because you're the one that really, really pushed for it, actually, was the last couple of years, we've just moved around like crazy in order to find good places for me to train over the winter. We have our beautiful home in Durango, which you just finished building before we met, and that's a big sacrifice you've had to make, is saying goodbye to that sweet home, your dream home in Durango during the winter. And we would bounce all over the place and chase good weather and chase these different opportunities, predominantly for my training. And we realized we were just moving around way, way too much. And inevitably, whenever you pack up and move to a new location, there's just lost days, lost time. It's stressful, et cetera. And so can you explain a little bit about kind of what you identified as maybe the best or a better setup and how we've structured that this year for both of our goals?
Yeah, I think last year, well, with your transition, you know, you had left Trek and signed with Allied, and you're, you know, handling this privateer life in a bigger way than you ever had, and just trying to manage everything and the travel. And we were moving around so much that I think we were just trying to figure out what baseline could be. And it took us a long time to get to a place of feeling calm. And I don't actually think that we ever got to that last year. I think we were just constantly bouncing around. And as your partner, I know that you like to be moving around that much, but where I see you thrive the most is when you can actually put your feet down. And we never got that last year. And so just trying to figure out what a home base could look like, because obviously we can't be in Durango. We can't be in Durango in the winter. And it's actually not a great place to be in the spring either, because our house is nestled at 8,000 feet. And so there's a lot of snow It's not, you know, you training at altitude year round is just not, it's not a recipe for success for you.
Yeah. For those that don't, I, growing up in Texas, I remember thinking, oh, March is when the weather gets good. But in Durango, and especially up high where above Durango where we live, oftentimes there's just mud season well into the end of April. So,
yeah, and that inevitably meant that we were like, okay, like we're going to spend 3 weeks in Tucson and then we'll go to LA and then we'll go to Santa Cruz. And it every single time we'd shuffle, you would lose an entire day and it was stressful. And yes, California is beautiful and these places were really wonderful, but I felt like you never really had everything that you needed. So we'd go to LA where, you know, you could climb these amazing roads for a long time and be happy, but then you would kind of get bored. We'd want mountain biking and so we'd move. And it just wasn't, to me, it wasn't the full package. And you also just couldn't fully focus on your training because we were constantly moving. And all of that moving resulted in getting sick and more stress. And anyway, so we
And it hamstrung. I mean, the other thing is it puts so much more responsibility on you to kind of patch up things when they would start to fall apart because of all that moving stuff. And then you didn't have as much time to focus on your goals.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good, assessment there.
Yeah. So long story short, we decided to base in Girona all winter and it was incredible. We spent 3 months there. It was perfect. It was awesome. We don't really need to talk about that right now. Maybe that's a different podcast at a different time. Maybe when we do it again next year, because we absolutely will be. Another development is that we decided to move forward on a home here in Bentonville. And there were different motivations for that. Some probably very obvious. We really love it here. We have lots of connections. It's an unbelievable place to be. If you're in the bike industry, and also, you know, my biggest sponsor Allied is here, and being a big part of what they have cooking in the future is important to me. And it's also a really, really good place to be in the spring. So kind of what we've settled on, it seems like, is Girona in the winter, Bentonville in the spring, Colorado, Durango throughout the summer, and then a quick little hit of Bentonville again in the fall when those last big races happen. But those are kind of our three home bases for the time being. And we feel unbelievably lucky.
Yeah, I think being able to find, even though moving between three places sounds like a lot, we still were able to find routine in each of those places, which I think has been huge for us, just being able to function in the ways that we need to.
Yep. So that's how our lives have evolved in regards to my goals and your goals. But we're here to talk about your goals today and what you're up to and your projects. I do think we need to quickly do some background about Path of Logic for folks who have not heard those podcasts from back in 2020. But I think we should maybe just start with the challenge of going there at a very basic level, just literally getting there.
Yeah. Getting to Uganda, you know, I've done it a lot. I've got a pretty good routine with what the things that I need to prepare before going. And a lot of, I don't want to say the challenges, but you just kind of have to think ahead, because really anything that I were to forget going to Uganda, that you're probably not going to find it there. And it takes a lot of planning. You have to have all of your equipment. You have to think ahead on the projects. And then a really big variable this year was Sammy. So Sammy Sari, I met her in Girona last year. She and I were riding bikes this year, and she has always been interested in the work in Uganda. And she just said, are you going to Uganda this year? And I said, yes, in a couple weeks. She said, are you taking your bike? I said, yes. She said, I really would like to come with you. And, you know, Sammy had said something last year about wanting to come, but I know that we have a lot of friends that are really talented photographers and media people. And I know that it takes someone that is artistic and good at their art to be able to help tell a story. But I also know to pay a photographer and a videographer what they're worth, it would be more than my budget for the whole year of the Path of Logic work. So when people talk about wanting to come, I'm always like, that would be great. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, someday when when I'm making five times the amount of money that I am, then we can go storytell. And
when
I
you would, have five times the budget, because you're not making any money on this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm making zero money. When the budget of Path of Logic for the projects goes yeah. up, I thought maybe at some point I could pay someone to help us, you know, explain what we're doing. But, you know, that time is definitely not now. And so when people talk about it, I dream for the future, but I don't actually think it's going to happen anytime soon. And so Sammy was very insistent upon coming. And she was really excited. And when I, you know, explained to her, I'm like, hey, like, I really would love for you to come, but these are the limitations of Path of Logic. And she just said, this year, I have a shift in my own life. And I want to get away from just doing commercial shoots. And I want to storytell around women doing interesting things in sport. I want to come with you. If you'll have me, I'm going. And that's just it. It happened. Yep. And so, yeah.
She donated her time and expertise.
She did. Yep. And it's unbelievably, yeah, I can't describe how thankful I am for that. But anyway, all that to say, my first issue getting to Uganda this year was one that I haven't dealt with in the past, which is, you know, visas in Uganda have always been required, but you used to buy them in Uganda once you landed. And 2 years ago, that changed, but it was still a pretty clunky system last year. And so this year, I had applied for my visa, and then I amended the time that I was going to be there to reflect Sammy's time. And the visa itself was in process when I left on the trip. And I didn't think that I would actually have an issue because, you know, of the 8 years that I've gone, it hasn't mattered. You can get your visa finalized on the spot. But I didn't understand how hardline that was until I was standing in Brussels trying to get on the airplane. They're like, well, it has to say approved. And so I was on the phone, and I have a contact, a friend in Uganda who has friends within the airline system, and they were trying to expedite this process. And they did. They actually got my visa was approved 20 minutes after my flight left Brussels. Anyway, it's just been a disaster of travel. But long story short, I arrived in Uganda, I guess it would have been about 16 hours later than I was supposed to. And in that process, I found myself on a stranger's couch taking an hour nap in Brussels with two very sweet dogs. And, you know, that was just a very kind older man who used to work for the airport. He was doing some volunteer work, saw that I was distressed and offered me to sleep on his couch. And I was so destroyed mentally and emotionally that I was just like, an hour sounds amazing. So, yeah, I took an hour nap at a stranger's house. I took a shower. And
can you explain why you were okay doing that?
I can explain that, but I will also say that I was very tired, and I don't think I would have said yes if I wasn't desperate. Like, I had not slept. I was going on, I guess, close to 48 hours of actual I needed to sleep.
Yep.
But yes, I didn't just hop into the stranger's car. He got probably, I don't know, four or five hugs from random women who were working at the airport. You could tell that he was just a very, very sweet old man. And he also was willing. I told him before I got in the car that I was going to call you to put you at ease and that we were going to FaceTime. And, and he was okay with that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I can't say that that's a foolproof system. He definitely could have been a weirdo, but I was in a state of being that I was just like, I'm going to trust this man. He's very sweet. I'm going to take a solid nap, and maybe it'll turn this trip around for me, because I was just straight exhausted. But that's what happened, and he was great. And when I made it to Uganda, instead of making it, I was supposed to arrive the night before at 10 p.m. So I would have had a full night of sleep before starting the adventure. Basically, I got off the plane and started the adventure. So it took me a very long time to catch up on sleep, but note to self, that will not happen again. And I will not, I will not put an airline in the position to have to hold me back.
Okay. So let's dive into the trip now, but first I want to go down a list of the five things that we're hoping to kind of talk about today, because Path of Logic is a charity that focuses on improving health outcomes in Equatorial Africa and developing countries, but Equatorial Africa specifically, Uganda even more specifically. But over the course of the past 8 years, you keep seeing problems, seeing places you can have an impact, and adding things on. So I'm just going to kind of rattle down the list of these five things that we're going to try to talk about, the five things you have going on right now as far as Path of Logic goes, and then we'll sort of dive into each as makes sense timeline-wise and all that sort of thing. So the first thing and the longest-standing component of, and jump in whenever you want to correct me, but the longest-standing aspect of Path of Logic, which, by the way, is a play on words of pathology, is all of this started because of you're traveling over there to teach at the Imbrari University of Science and Technology. So that's kind of item one. Item two is a biopsy clinic that is a side project of Path of Logic, which you started last year. And this trip, in part, was to check in on that biopsy clinic, and we'll get into the goals of that and what you were doing there and what a biopsy clinic is. Three, animated film. You're making an animated film with Disney animators that live in Uganda. We'll get into that. The light distribution project, which very ironically is like the very smallest part of Path of Logic, but it's the most easily understood. So it's the one that so many people latch onto, and they're like, oh, you do these rides out in the countryside and you distribute lights to, you know, solar lamps to villages that don't have electricity. It's like, yeah, that is definitely something Nico does. That's really a special experience and opportunity, but that's like 1% of your time. But we will talk about that a little bit. And then, of course, there's the Johns Hopkins component, where you're finishing up your master's, and we'll talk a little bit about why you decided to go back to school and what it's been like to be at the preeminent medical school around. How was that? Does that sound good? Did I do okay?
You did great.
Anything to add before we dive into those?
No, it's just, I know, and it's hard to say this to you because you do know so much about what I'm doing, but they really are also very, very connected, mm-hmm. right? Like, teaching is what took me to Uganda, and building trust with the doctors I was training is what allowed me insight into gaps that I could help fill with Path of Logic. And all of those gaps that have been brought to me by my colleagues have spawned these projects. And they all have one basic goal, which is just to improve pathology in Uganda and allow people to survive cancers. Because cancer
Cancer is pathology.
Cancer is pathology.
I didn't know that, FYI. So don't be sad if you didn't either.
It's not, cancer is not the only thing that that pathology umbrellas over, but it is a big part of it. And cancer is complicated to treat in resource lacking places. And so with Path of Logic, we've kind of taken a bottom-up approach where we started with capacity building with the laboratory. And then once we identified that is no longer the most imminent issue, it's getting patients in soon enough so that all of these pieces can come together and a patient can actually be cured of their cancer, right? Like, we're trying to save lives, and I have a small piece of that puzzle where I'm there and I can get my hands on resources to help solve some of these issues. But our team together has put all of these pieces there, and it's been really exciting to just kind of be a part of it. And yeah, so everything that you just named off, those five bits, all do work together. And yeah, I'm excited to give a little bit more context into that.
Can we try to briefly just answer the question of why Uganda?
Why Uganda? Yeah, we did a whole, I should have a one sentence response to that.
But that's the hard part, is like it's not even a one paragraph answer, you know, because it's a story. It's about you getting really inspired about a place and you having specific skill sets and a specific history that allows you to have a very big impact there. And that's not something you can explain in a sentence.
Well, it actually is more simple than that. I just wanted to find a place where the expertise that I do have could be shared. And I had one project that we talked about in one of our early podcasts that was in Haiti, and that was not a place where I could add anything. And so not even knowledge, me teaching, you know, basically fell short because they didn't have the resources to carry on that, you know, the education. And so Uganda was very simple. It was the very first teaching opportunity that I found, someone that was looking for someone with my background to come and teach pathology. And I knew that I wanted to learn what was sustainable pathology in a low-income country. I went to learn and to teach the little subset of knowledge that I could share, and realized that I really did love the place. I love the work. I was starting to bond with the residents. I knew that I didn't even, not even a chip of the iceberg. That's probably the wrong way to say that, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like when I left my first trip, I realized how much I didn't know and how much I wanted to learn and how much I wanted to continue to connect with these residents, you know, after learning about some of the shortcomings and, you know, just how inspiring those professionals are to be working in their field. So yes, Uganda happened by chance, but I stayed because I am inspired by those doctors. And honestly, to have any context of a place that I'm just going to be visiting for 3 weeks to a month, you have to keep going to the same place. You're never going to understand. I'm still understanding Uganda, and it's been an honor that they've wanted me to keep coming back. And so as long as they'll have me, I'll keep going. And we have a lot of projects going on that feel really, really cool to be a part of.
Yeah. And now and then you get the question, well, why not here? Why not? If you're such a well-intentioned person that wants to help others, why not address the problems that we have, you know, much closer here in the States? How would you describe, or how would you explain going all the way to Uganda every year to try to make the world a better place?
Well, I am trying to make the world a better place, but I'm specifically, my tools are within the field of pathology. And in the U.S., we have these wonderful things that are like these big medical schools with lots of boards and rules and, you know, teaching criteria, and our residents are not like, I couldn't go and volunteer at a medical school here and give knowledge that wouldn't already be part of their curriculum. And so going somewhere where that's not necessarily like hands-on instruction about anatomic dissections is not, you know, something that is readily available to the residents in low-income countries. So it was looking for a place that specifically needed that help that I applied to, and that's just not, it's not applicable here.
So the last question that I'm curious about before we dive into specifics is, why are you so committed to this work? Because I think some people have a phase maybe where they do some philanthropic work, but they don't make it the focus of their life's work. You walked away from a great career so that you can focus fully on this for now? Why are you so committed, and why did you decide to really stick your neck out there in a way?
I think feeling the success of one project on, like, I feel like it was a really, really big success that our group experienced through a problem that we were solving together, which was that reporting system. So, you know, it was 5 years ago, I helped facilitate a computer programmer to create a system that could just give electronic results for patients for their pathology reports. And that sounds like a very small thing. And technically, it probably is a very small thing. But watching what just the transition from paper records to electronic records, what that was able to do on this large scale, and then watching other clinicians ask for it and having it expand across the entire country, and realizing that, wow, I was a part of something that can have such a large impact, and being a part of a team where you see something like that, like a tangible just expansion of an idea and something that we knew the laboratory needed, and watching what could happen when people are excited about a project. And so I think just being a part of that project itself made me realize that, like, that is the priority of global health, is, you know, trying to implement changes that have a ripple effect that can impact a population of people. So realizing that work gave me more energy than I could ever imagine getting out of my day job, which was just working at the hospital at Mercy. I realized that if I could work every single day feeling that sort of energy, knowing that the work that I'm doing has the impact of reaching so many people. And yeah, I think that is what pushed me into doing this work, is just realizing that I can be a part of this puzzle.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what created the momentum that sort of made this a lasting passion and also earned respect within your peer group and field, that what you were doing was really legitimate and you were capable of spearheading some things that really made a big difference. But for folks that don't operate in that world, can you explain why an online record-keeping system is such a breakthrough and makes such a difference, as opposed to just writing names and dates down in a big book, which is the way it was working before?
Yeah. The way, it's actually fascinating. The system worked, but it was very slow. So, you know, a patient would come in, and like you said, they put patient's name in their book. They'd be given a number that they, each patient's medical records are basically carried around in this little booklet. Every patient has a booklet, and in that booklet, people write their results for various tests in them. And the pathology book was this gigantic book that it was just very easy after a patient walked away for a few months and came back. You'd flip through the book and you'd try to find the results. And those results had, before they could be written, had to go through about 4 to 5 different people to get to the point where there was a diagnosis in the book. And that was the secretary, the doctors in training, the pre-analytic staff, lots of moving parts. And sometimes those moving parts, when they're just on paper, would get lost. And so some patients never had results make it to the book. And then ones that did, sometimes they would sit in a secretary's office for, you know, 2-3 weeks. 47 days was actually the average turnaround time for a patient for the results to make it into the book, 47 days. And then a patient has to come back, and then you have to flip through the book to then find the patient's results. So it was very inefficient. And
47 days is a long time when someone might have cancer.
Yes. And a lot of times, patient may never get their results. And so the electronic system tracks the day that the case was signed out. It gives the patient the results, and they're easy to find, and much like the whole process reduced from 47 to 13 after a year. So when a patient comes in to get the results, they can just give their name. They can type the name into the system, and then you get a fully ready PDF of a patient's results, which are, you know, signed out by user-specific pathology sign-outs. So, yeah, that's what the system does.
So one of the other things that you've done for the past 8 years with Pathologic and the Embraer University of Science and Technology, which we call MUST, one of the other things that you do or help with is order and deliver new equipment. And sometimes it's big stuff like a fume hood. Sometimes it's smaller things, little materials. But maybe just tell us what you did in that regard this year with just equipment or some of the other things that you focused on outside of checking in on the electronic record keeping system and doing some teaching.
This year, I did not bring any new equipment. In the past, I have. You know, it's usually small things that are identified by the doctors from year to year. This year, the big objective was checking in on the biopsy clinic that you were talking about. The biopsy clinic is actually a breast biopsy clinic. We had chosen breast cancer to focus on to really dial in the diagnostic process of one disease, so just breast. And last year, we started a biopsy clinic that women could come with, you know, a palpable mass, get a biopsy. We'd run all of the testing that we'd need to for pathology, give them a result, and just kind of track what we're seeing over the year with these breast biopsies, and also give people quick, reliable results that could then, you know, direct their treatments. And so last year, when we opened this clinic, in tandem, we started a research study to actually take a deep dive into the cases that come in. Like, where did those women come from? What did they know about breast cancer beforehand? You know, how long have they had symptoms? Do those patients have HIV? Things that can impact the way that cancer is acting in the body. And so we started that research study a year ago, and I needed to check in and see how our data was coming along, and then also train someone to start the next phase of the process, which is checking in with the women that had those biopsies after a year to see if they had had treatment and what their barriers are. So we're trying to give, you know, basically a big summary publication that explains not only, you know, the referral pathway of a patient, but also, you know, what happened after their biopsy. Because ultimately, we don't want to just accurately diagnose a patient. We want them to get treatment fast enough, and we also want their disease to be cured. And there's lots of moving parts to that process. So, you know, that research project is a big part of it. And then the animation project that you're talking about also works directly with that biopsy clinic. And so we know that a big issue with breast cancer specifically is that there are a lot of stigmas around cancer in general, and specifically with breast cancer as well. And those stigmas and barriers make it so that when patients arrive to the clinic, their cancer is advanced. And once cancer is advanced to a certain point, it's very difficult to treat. And so we identified, and this is years ago, you know, looking at the fact that, you know, 70% of women will show up with disease that has advanced too far to be treated. So how do we tackle that problem? And that was the problem that led me to grad school. That is the problem that I wanted to help answer. You talk to pathology professional after pathology professional in Uganda, and you say, what do we need to do? And they all say, well, we need a chance for what we're doing to make an impact. And to do that, we need to actually get down to the community level and teach people about what the capacity of pathology services are, and try to get people in sooner than they have been. And so I'm not rambling, but
no, this is amazing.
So me choosing to go to grad school to help answer that question, the very first class that I took was a persuasive theories course at Johns Hopkins, and I went through a bunch of different just theory about how to communicate about a public health problem. And with highly stigmatized issues, narrative persuasion is a really great tool to use, which is, you know, storytelling. And there are lots of examples of public health initiatives where a novella can be used to show a story and have a patient, you know, or a person be transferred into that story and just, you know, feel some emotions around the story and then also have some of their stigmas addressed. And so very first class, I had learned about persuasive theories and using narrative persuasion as a tool to reach people. And then that progressed and progressed and progressed. And we did, you know, we talked to a human production company, and I say human using actors and actresses, based out of Must, to talk about, you know, what that would look like to create an actual film with actors and actresses. And to have that based in a public health setting, it takes a very, very long time because basically every phase of creating a film, you need to test with patients. You need them to tell you, yeah, I don't like that, or that message went over my head, or that doesn't, you know, I don't like that. So focus groups with public health are really important so that you are testing what it is that you're trying to make as far as the message goes. And so, long story short, we thought about, could we use animation to tell a story? And the problems that animation helps us solve are that a big, big barrier with communication in Uganda is the fact that a large percentage of the population are illiterate. And then there are also 41 languages in the country. And so if you are trying to reach a lot of people, you're going to need to have that same message translated a bunch of different times. And that can be very challenging, especially if you're using actors and actresses. But if you're using animation, it's more easily adapted, and we can use voiceover technology. And actually, you know, with a good animator, such that we have, they can actually sync the mouth movements of the characters to match the other languages fairly easy, where using human actors and actresses, that would not be as easy. So we kind of went down this rabbit hole of like, okay, maybe we can do this with animation. And then I had reached out to, I just did some searching online to see if I could find an African production team that could help. And somehow there's an amazing production company based in Kampala. And I say somehow, Raymond will tell you it is unbelievable that they have, that in Kampala, Uganda, there's a team of, I think, 10. There are 10 animators that are working together, and they just finished a contract with Disney, and they're absolutely incredible and just masters of their craft, and they just happen to be in Uganda. And yeah, I sent Raymond, their founder of that production team, a message on Instagram. And that was 2 years ago. My first conversation with Raymond was 2 years ago. And now we are full production right now. And so part of this trip was going and meeting with the animation team and kind of sorting through some little story snags and just getting things buttoned up enough that we could test the phase that we're at right now with a focus group of women for them to give us their feedback of this film. And so I guess, long story short, of animation, it's what we are trying to do to help solve that original problem, which is getting women into the clinic faster.
Yep.
And now working to do this storytelling, this completely new, like, learning about animation and it's been incredible.
Yeah, that was honestly so well described. One thing I think it would be interesting for people to hear about is why you wanted to prioritize Ugandan animators.
Yes, with any public health initiative, it should be community-based, and that starts from every aspect of the project should be community-based in the context of where you're working. And so the problem was identified by the doctors in Uganda. If a story is going to be told, it should be told by storytellers in Uganda. The context and relating to people is unbelievably important. It's probably the most important thing, is that the message is correct. And it would be very easy for, you know, someone in the U.S. to hear the problem and totally skip over really important information. And so Raymond and his team are able to relate. And this is actually very funny, because when Raymond did his, I had Raymond and one of his teammates out to Embrara to do a site visit. And he was mind blown. He's like, oh, I'm so glad that we came out here, because, you know, there's all these things that are different over here in Embrara than they are to Kampala. And he's just like, oh, you know, your houses are this way, and the way this is set is this way. And
yeah.
He, you know, he recognizes how important it is for him to do his own homework of southwestern Uganda. And so having somebody that is not like a local to Uganda would be a complete failure.
Disaster,
it wouldn't work.
Because ultimately you have to convince people to care about the message that you're trying to send. And if subtle things feel contrived, or like an outsider is trying to give them advice, such as the houses look different than in the area, like you just mentioned, people are going to probably tune out, or at the very least be very skeptical.
Yeah, the message isn't for them. They'll think this message is for someone else.
Yep.
This message is for someone that's not like me.
Yep.
And there's no better way to communicate a message to people than for it to be like, it is all community based, like everything from the origin of the project to the animators. It's actually quite an interesting place for me to be, because in general, I don't say a whole lot. I feel like I'm more of a project manager than someone who's giving real input. Like, I try to, you know, if I have something to say, I'll be like, wow, okay, this is this is a good public health thing to keep in mind. But, you know, I try to stay as much out of the way as I can and just let, you know, kind of put the right people in the room to tell the story.
Yeah. One other specific bit about this animation project was when you were problem solving how to address the actual content, which is breasts, and how to make it not jarring or off-putting. Because, I mean, even here in the States, if you have, you know, a health-related film and there's just boobs out everywhere, like, some people are going to maybe recoil just a little bit or be like, oh, this is kind of weird. But in Uganda, there's even more social stigma around that sort of thing.
Yes.
So how did you address that problem?
Well, that was a funny problem, because Raymond is a man, and and this is his first public health project. And so his own instincts about storytelling, he's tried to like kind of step back a little bit. And he's like, okay, we're telling a story about breasts. Like, we're just going to have like the first iteration of the film. So one of the main points of the film is to educate people how to perform a breast exam. So how to feel for a mass, because that is how breast masses are detected. Mammograms are not used very often. I think there's one mammogram facility in the entire country. And so doing a breast exam is very important. So we explain how to do that. And in the first iteration of the film, I think Raymond had just two breasts descend onto the screen. And then he, you know, like a diagram. He was trying to do like you know, medical diagram of like what you do to do a breast exam. And it's funny because he was uncomfortable with it, but he's also like, I'm making a movie about breasts. So anyway, we had to talk about that. And together we had kind of done some like, well, how do we make this not uncomfortable? We don't want, because the point of a narrative, you know, you're using narrative persuasion. People are supposed to like put themselves in the position of the character. So how do we make the breasts not feel real? And, you know, almost make it funny. And so together we had come to a couple different ideas of like using fruit as like the substitute for the breast. And so there's a fictitious character. She's a pamphlet subject who comes to life in the film, and she has two fruits descend down from the screen, and then there's just like a lot of awkward, you know, fruit adjusting and fruit palpating and lots of like, you know, it's meant to be funny and lighthearted and yeah. And people to relate to, oh, I had some papayas, like that makes sense to me. Yeah. So yeah, we're using fruits, and it's been really fun to, you know, work with Raymond on how do we creatively make this stigmatized, kind of uncomfortable topic a little bit light. And he's a brilliant animator and artist, and I'm really excited to see, you know, we're at the phase of the film where the pictures are starting to move. So they call them animatics, where you have the story, you have the characters, and now they're like in this like kind of moving sketch phase. And it's been really fun to see it all come together.
Yeah. Yeah. So at this stage, I think I'd like to kind of start to transition towards category number four, which is light distribution. And I think maybe a transition here is just that, you know, you've picked up on a lot culturally that guides your decision making with this work over the last 8 years. And obviously you pick up on plenty just being around the university in Embrar and that sort of thing, but you have such an incredible knowledge base about the country as a whole, in part because you've spent a lot of time on your bike riding around the countryside. So it's not just the medical people and personnel that you're exposed to. You've exposed yourself to the entire population of people. You're not just getting to know the people that are trying to solve these problems and work on these projects that you're working on. You're also getting to know the people that you're trying to help. For example, the people that you're going to be distributing this film to. And I know that's a really, really important piece too. There's a component of adventure and the fact that you're an outdoor athlete and you want to go on big bike rides and see the world, but there is a direct relationship to the work also in regards to your bike riding around the countryside. And there's this wonderful little side project where you're distributing empowered Lucy lamps, which is actually, when it comes to packing, one of the biggest challenges, which maybe we can talk about. But can you describe a little bit about how this piece of Path of Logic came about, the piece that, for whatever reason, like I said before, people seem to latch onto most because it's most easily understood, but you really only spend 4 or 5 days per trip on it, but I know it's near and dear to your heart all the same.
Yeah, so my first trip to Uganda was pretty challenging. I didn't bring a bike that trip. I was just getting my bearings with global health, and I, you know, as a newcomer to global health, I did struggle with just being introduced to the realities of healthcare in a place like Embrara. And I knew that I wanted to keep coming back, but I knew that I needed an outlet when I was there. And I needed to be able to process what I was experiencing. And so I had made the decision on my first trip that I did not have my bike, that the next year I really wanted to take my bike with me. And I didn't actually, I didn't think that I would be connecting with people, and that wasn't its original purpose. It was more like, I need to be able to process here if this is going to be sustainable for me. And so I went home, and basically over the next year, it would enter and exit my brain of just like, okay, this is going to be very fun. It's going to be adventurous. How do I prepare to do that? And also what was happening that very first, after that first visit, was I had my very first fundraiser to raise money for the projects of the next year. And at the time, I would sell one bike, and then I was just cold calling all of these companies to be like, hey, I'm Nicole, and I'm doing this project that's very out there, but I'm looking, I'm trying to get product to sell for this fundraiser. And so a lot of companies were like, yeah, I'll send you a paddle. Like, why what a paddle? I did. I had a...
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Or I'll send you, like, here's a hat or, you know, all this stuff. And one of the companies that I reached out to was Empowered. And I had asked them to donate some lights for my fundraiser. And I had sent them this, like, deck about the work that I was doing. And their marketing manager, Scott, reached out to me, and he said, we'd love to send you product for your fundraiser, but also, we have never done work in Uganda with our, our team has this Lucy Give program where each light that is purchased, there's a light that is donated to go to these, different projects around the world that are, typically resource scarce places. And if you have any interest, maybe we can work together in that way. And I said yes. I called Abraham, who I call for every project. Hey, Abraham, do you think that there would be use for these lights in Uganda?
Abraham is your longest standing coworker and closest friend in Uganda.
Yes. Yep. Sorry. I need to. Everybody knows who Abraham is. Yes. But Abraham, anytime I have a question, he's the person that I call. So anyway, after talking to Scott, I had asked Abraham if he thought that the lights would be of use. And he said they would be to children, and they would be in some of the rural areas of Imbrara that don't have steady, reliable electricity or sometimes any electricity at all. And so I said yes to Scott, and then I had already planned to take my bike. And then when I started adding it all up, I realized that, I'm very busy with these projects, and so I didn't have a ton of time. And at the time, I was using all of my vacation to go to Uganda. And so I didn't really have a lot of time. Those first trips were, 2 to 3 weeks long. And so that doesn't leave big gaps of time to do, non-pathology projects. And so I put the two together. And I was like, maybe I can distribute these lights by bike. And it kind of solves the problem of getting to these more rural spots. And maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, but I'm going to try. And so that it just kind of happened because logistically it had to for all the pieces to come together. And after my very first trial of trying to distribute these lights, I realized that it wasn't just the lights. It was also being on the bike and being, solo on the countryside that I was vulnerable, and people really enjoyed coming and talking to me. And it was like the best medium to be, out and connecting with people, and then add the lights to the scenario. And it just, it's been a really precious project where I feel like not only am I reaching these hard to reach places, I'm also connecting with people. I'm seeing the countryside. I'm seeing the places that people are living. I'm understanding how far these places are from the medical centers of the area. And yeah, it gave me my first real experience outside of the hospital. And so it's been a key component of these trips. I've done it every single year since that second year arriving in Uganda. And it is like, I look forward to it so much each year.
And how many, you're distributing around, is it like 250 lights a year? Is that right?
It's
that you schlep over?
It's about 200.
200 lights a year.
And the projects themselves, like, I think it is important to talk about the evolution of the light projects. So my first 2 years, all the lights were distributed in this, like, countryside, like, just, you know, show up at a village, distribute to only children. And that was working, but it also felt like, I don't know, it when you arrive in a village and then you've got, you know, maybe 20 children that you're giving lights to, many of those children are going back to the same house. And it's not that I didn't think that it was impactful, but it didn't feel like it was very equitable, because you weren't necessarily reaching every single hut in that village. You're reaching a group of children, and those children might go back to the same place. And in talking to Abraham, we had shifted the project to try to actually reach some schools. And so I think it was the third year that I started trying to visit schools, and we ended up, this ended up being a really great way to reach kids. And so we are focusing on P7 children. So these are children that are about to test into secondary school.
Which is about what age?
Maybe 11. Yep. I think 11.
Mm-hmm.
But the way education is structured in Uganda, primary school is schooling that is offered to every child. Can go through school up until about age 11. And then from there, they have to test into secondary school. And secondary schools are usually private also, so they do cost money as well. But you do have to test into it. And these kids that are without electricity are competing against students that have electricity. And so a lot of those kids are just kind of not left behind, but, you know, they don't really have a great shot, and they don't feel encouraged to study when they go home, because once it's dark, there's no more reading. And so that was kind of the idea behind targeting those kids. And so we have been visiting the same school for the last 3 years, and it's now become where the majority of the lights go, are to these P7 students. And because we can give one to each P7 student in the whole district, which is really great. So that has become more prioritized, because, you know, the likelihood that two of those students in the same classroom will go to the same house is pretty low. So we know that we're reaching, you know, around 200 families. And it's also going to kids that can feel empowered for that particular phase of their education to really focus on school and feel motivated to study for that test.
Yeah. So how many years have you been doing this now? Seven?
Yeah. Yeah. It's been 7 years.
So well over 1,000 lights now.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, it's pretty funny, the massive Osprey duffel that you chock full of all of these lights and schlep over there.
Yeah.
And this year, I think you, didn't you go to a village and you found some of the lights that you distributed years ago, and they're still working and being used? I think I saw that. Did you post a photo?
It's very sweet.
That?
That was last year.
That was last year. Okay.
Well, last year's objective was to figure out how long do these lights actually last? And because I don't think that there have been, like, Empowered, they do these Lucy Give programs, but, you know, it's really tough to then follow up on how the light is used. And mm-hmm. so I thought that I would be able to find some of these in the wild, and it actually was quite challenging, but I did find a few, and they were still working, beat up, but working. And so that has felt good. Those lights last year were 5 years old and still working, which is really incredible. Yeah. It's a good product.
And can you describe some of these rides? Because they're huge. I mean, some of the rides that you've done are just absolutely incredible. I got to do a couple of the routes in 2021, and it was just mind-boggling, the terrain. But can you give folks a little bit of context about the style riding and maybe the bike that you've found works the best?
Yeah, I think, well, I've always taken a hardtail, except for the year you came, because you're always concerned about weight. And so
we tried to
use gravel bikes that year, and it was quite miserable. So
it was definitely the wrong move.
Yeah, definitely the wrong move. So I've used a Yeti hardtail every trip, which has been really great. This year I upgraded and I was on a 29er, which is wonderful, the new ARC. Yeah, the bike rides, there's not a ton of single track in Uganda. It's mostly dirt road, but the dirt road is quite adventurous because they get quite beat up and, you know, degraded and, yeah, pretty rough terrain. My goals have always been to, like, see as much of the catchment area of the hospital, which means, like, you know, the geographic area that people could come to the hospital to visit. So the people served by the hospital I was working at,
mm-hmm.
Southwest Uganda. So the first route, I think the full route was a little over 300 miles. And basically from Imbrara to the border of DRC, which is a national forest. So windy impenetrable forest, and then, you know, another 100 miles southeast and then back to the hospital. And so each of the trips is usually 3 days long and, you know, just covers a different area of Uganda. At this point, I've seen a lot.
Yeah,
been all over the place.
Yeah, the 100 miler route to Bwindi is really hard. It's hard riding. I remember doing it and just thinking, one of the hardest 100 miles I've ever done. And it's also kind of trippy because you're on the equator, so it's hot and humid and you're in a rainforest. But that one day is basically one huge mountain pass and you get up to 9,000 feet. And so you have thin air and that high altitude feel, but you're just sweating and, like, getting hit in the face with vines and stuff. It's really interesting. And one other thing is one of the Grand Prix racers this year is Ugandan, Jordan Schleck, and lives in Kampala and trains on those roads.
Yeah.
Really cool. I'm looking forward to catching up with him.
I cannot wait for you to podcast with him.
I know. I'm really looking forward to that. Nice. Okay.
We should talk about the fact that, like, what was unique about this year. So I repeated the same route that I sent Payson on. And it was also my very first route that I had done. But I took Sammy.
Yeah.
And so when you did it, I was not with you. And it's just kind of funny to experience a place with someone who's seeing it for the first time. I actually learned a lot by Sammy being there because I think having two cyclists together did actually change the dynamic that I was experiencing with people. I think people were less comfortable coming up and talking to me. And because Sammy is such an awesome person, she recognized it really quick. And it was because Sammy was riding with me and she, you know, she had a camera on her back. And I think when you have more than one person, people are a little bit more, it feels a little bit more intrusive than being out there on your own. So at one point, Sammy chose to get back in the vehicle so that I could, you know, do the, you know, the ride and the light distribution in a more authentic way.
Yep.
And so that was very interesting and also amazing of Sammy to pick that up, because I don't know that I would have felt comfortable asking her to, like, hey, can you put your bike in the car? Like, you brought it all the way here, but
yeah.
But
that's been an interesting, I mean, even bigger picture than that. So you just mentioned a vehicle, and we should clarify that. So that's been an interesting evolution too, where in the early days you had this very, I'm going to use the word, cavalier sort of attitude about riding through the countryside, and you were very fearless. And you've talked about in the past some, or I should say we've talked about how you didn't necessarily feel like you had much to lose, maybe. And I don't know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but there was maybe a little bit of recklessness or just sending it, you know? You were just going to go where you were going to go. You were fiercely independent. You were going to have these experiences. You were going to meet these people. And, I mean, we should acknowledge that this area that you're riding is right smack dab next to DRC, Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is one of the most troubled countries in the world. And I mean, we've told the story, we don't have to tell the story again, but there was one year where you accidentally ended up in the middle of kind of a hostage exchange situation where you weren't the hostage, but like you ended up at the same hotel. And this year there were question marks about some safety too, with rebels coming across the border and that sort of thing. So over time, and in part because you have Ray Ray and me to come home to, the system you have now is you have a vehicle just sort of in the vicinity, and you'll kind of leapfrog now and then. But in order to be welcomed by the people in the countryside, you can't just have a car drive up. Like, the bike is disarming. And so you ride up with the lights and in a big, you know, backpack or like a bike packing saddlebag, frame bag, you know, have that interaction and continue on your way. And eventually, you know, you meet the vehicle and at a hotel that evening or a lodge or wherever you're staying. But in the beginning, it was a lot looser.
Well, yes, you and Ray have a lot to do. Lot to do with that, but I also have grown up a lot since that point. And I don't know, I just felt like if I relied on a vehicle too much, that it would take away from it actually feeling like an adventure. And that was like, that was a high priority for me in the early days, was just to feel more independent. And it's not that I don't look at these trips as adventures anymore, but having a translator is very important. And then also, you know, safety is a consideration. And so, yeah, being a little less, a little less stubborn, I'll use the word stubborn, mm-hmm. And being able to rely more on Abraham, being able, you know, if I show up at a village and I don't have help translating, you risk giving lights to a group of people that may not completely understand how they're supposed to be able to use them. So I think having somebody there to help translate, having a car that can help with safety concerns, and then also, you know, gives me the opportunity to reload lights as well.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Carrying 200 lights at once on a bike is...
Well, I've never been able to do that, but I was able to get, I think I've fit like 60 on myself and on my bike, and it hurts. So yeah, I think that whole process has evolved a lot over the years.
Yeah. Okay. So our fifth topic here to start tying up is Johns Hopkins. Why did you want to go back to school? Why did you want to go to graduate school?
I felt like the problem that I really wanted to focus on helping my region with, I was not equipped to handle, without more education. And so with my background as a PA in pathology, I'm not equipped to solve a public health problem. And so I knew that if I really did want to focus on population health, that I needed more schooling. And so that's what led me to grad school. And every course that I've taken along the way, most of the classes you're able to choose your projects and choose your focus, that whatever the class is covering is focused around. And I've always chosen the work that we're doing in Uganda as the focus. And so it's kind of been a really fabulous process to like have the work evolve with the school all working at the same time, like this biopsy clinic that we started. The first year of data I'm actually using for my thesis as my, you know, data analysis project that will be embedded into a grant application for getting the film distributed to one of the districts that's near Embrara. So it's incredible. It's incredible to be in Uganda filling in the gaps of this data that I'm working on currently, making sense of, and being able to, you know, see associations that have not been made in the past, and knowing that that is going to be the basis of what will allow us to then distribute this film out to a lot of people. It's demonstrating a need using data. It's fabulous.
You're one of the most humble people I know, so you're going to absolutely hate this question, but I have to ask it. Can you talk a little bit about what it means to be enrolled at Johns Hopkins?
Oh, dear.
Which is...
Peso.
It's special, Nico. I mean, it's something to be proud of, and you don't have to answer it as in like, oh, my dream's coming true. But what is it arming you with? Like, when you log into class there, what do you feel like you're getting from Johns Hopkins? What are they helping you do?
They're helping me be exposed to, in my opinion, the best research in the world. And my professors are accomplished authors. I feel like every single one of them is, you know, they're teaching, but they're also in academia, and they're also publishing things, and they have just a complete wealth of knowledge that I feel like is just really, you know, you're very inspired by listening to a professor speak to a subject that they are the master in, you know, that they're publishing things currently on. And if you have a question, they can actually speak, like you're reading a research paper, you have a question, and they can actually tell you what they were thinking about in the process of that publication. And that's pretty special. Yeah. So yeah, I am honored to be at the university, and I feel that the work we're doing in Uganda is deserving of having those experts guide it. So that's been nice. It's been really special.
Yeah. And it's worth kind of bringing it full circle too, and reminding people that you're doing this. You're going to Johns Hopkins from hotel rooms at Bike Races, from a tiny apartment in Girona, Spain, as you talk me off my ledge about having two bad training rides in a row or something. You know, to paint a little picture here, it is funny. Like, when you zoom out, our lives are just so ridiculous, Nico. Like, they're just very weird and extreme in some ways. And I very distinctly remember coming home from a really hard training ride in Girona this winter, and I really pushed it this winter. We pushed training harder than I ever have, and I spent a lot of time laying on the couch really, really tired. And you'd be sitting there at that little dining room table on your laptop on a Zoom class with your other peers at Johns Hopkins, and there was one time where you were broken out into groups and you were comparing projects, and you were a group of three, and two of your classmates presented their projects, and then you presented your project, and it was your project was the animation film, and you were talking about some different components some different things you were learning in school and how you were applying them to this animation project, and you didn't outright say this is a real project, but there were a couple tells, and your peers were kind of like, wait, your project isn't a hypothetical project, is it? And like, no, this is what I do. Like, this is something I'm doing. And they were just mind boggled. And it's so special to me and so inspiring. You know, again, going back to paint a picture of that room, you know, I'm laying on the couch feeling a certain way about my training one way or the other and trying to push myself as an athlete. But you're over there, you know, in a completely different realm at the absolute tip of the spear, even more so than some people may think that I am, if that makes sense. And yet so frequently I feel like I'm the one that's getting the greater recognition. And some of that is, you know, part of, like, you're just so humble, Nico. And I know you get annoyed with me when I try to, like, I don't know, bring up things that I'm proud of, and you try to, like, tamp it down. Like, no, don't talk about that. But it is really, really special, and I'm just so proud of you, and I just hope more people will tune into what you're doing and, you know, follow your updates on, you did more on Instagram this year, which was really sweet from your trip. And yeah, anyone who's listening who has questions about what you're up to, I hope they send them, and because it's really special. I'm just so, so proud of all of your hard work.
Thank you, Peso.
It was really funny when, because your peers, I think the goal of that was, of that assignment was to come up with a hypothetical project, right?
Well, I think in general, you know, a lot of my classmates are not, you know, they're not conducting their own research right now. They're planning to.
Yeah.
And yes, yeah, so most of our projects are ones that you want to do in the future. And that's been really unique, is that every project that I have proposed in these classes, I'm currently working on. So I'm getting feedback real time on projects that are actually being handled. And hilariously, I had pitched my thesis to my advisor, as I want to, my thesis will be this grant application, and I want to do data analysis from a clinic that will be starting, you know, at, and I had given him the time, and, you know, I had helped formulate the survey questions that are, you know, part of that project. And he literally laughed at me. He told me that I couldn't do it. He told me it was too much. and I'm doing it. Like, that's my thesis. And I'm working on the data analysis component of it right now. And there are lots of moving pieces, but I feel like the fact that I've been so immersed in the projects real time is allowing me to do so much more with the education than I would have otherwise. Had I just chosen to go into public health and then, you know, try to find something that I'm passionate about after. So that's been really, really cool.
The last thing I want to touch on quickly that might be on people's minds is just how do you fund all this? Because I think, I mean, you described a lot of things. Some people might even know, for example, that animated films are very, very expensive. Very expensive. How do you fund all this?
Well, I'm very honored to be a part of the Yeti Cycles family. And I sell all of my bikes and donate the funds from bike sales. And I have one fundraiser a year, which is actually coming up pretty soon.
And May 13th, we said, right?
May 13th is the proposed date. I've been trying to have this fundraiser for, I don't know, 5 months, and things just keep coming up. But
we'll be in one place for 2 weeks. So we said, this is it.
This is the time. So I'll be fundraising. And this fundraiser actually is very important because right now I am signed into a contract for this animation film and it's not fully paid for yet. So it's moving. I'm making payments as I'm raising the money, which is a little uncomfortable, but I know that it's important.
And you do have a few people that donate as well.
I do. Yep. I have a couple very, very amazing supporters that have been donating monthly to me as well.
Yeah. And they just do that through the donation portal on the Pathologic website, right?
Yeah.
So there's a little button you can hit and it takes you to a PayPal page and you can make a donation.
Indeed.
Along with the animation film, where do funds go?
Funds go to supporting the residents. I give living expense stipends to the doctors that are training to be pathologists.
Can you explain why you need to do that, by the way?
Yeah, that was actually my very first project that I had done with Pathologic. Was I had realized after my first year of teaching that the residents they're not supported in the same way that they are in the U.S. The way that I keep saying residents, but they're physicians that are specializing in another field. And in the U.S., residents are paid. And in Uganda, a lot of them are paid, but in pathology, they are not, because the government has not recognized pathology as being a really important field. And so a lot of these residents have second jobs to support their families. And so in seeing how just scrappy these guys are. They work, they teach medical students, they're doing all the diagnostic testing, they're doing autopsies, they're doing, and then they have jobs on the weekends. I just thought that it was, you know, a small way that I could contribute to them being the best that they can be in the field, because the field is only going to get better with those guys doing the work. And so, yeah, I've been supporting those residents for as long as, you know, I guess since 2018. So that's a big place that the money goes. I also am running that electronic record system. So there are small fees that are associated with that every year. We're at 5 sites. So it's 3 server fees. And
explain what that means, 5 sites.
5 hospitals are using that record.
So it's expanded to basically be the national record keeping system for pathology, right?
It has, yeah. And those have small fees associated that I pay out of pathologic funds. And then each year, if there's an equipment request, those are also paid for by pathologic. This year, we are going to try to build a better filing system for slides. They're past capacity of what they can hold. So it's been a mess, but that's an objective for next year. So yeah, little projects like that.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yep. And then going back to the record keeping system for a minute, do I remember correctly that there are a couple of surrounding countries interested in adopting your record keeping system also? Did I make that up?
It's not mine.
Well, your as in you and your team.
Yes, me and my team. Yeah, there has been some interest, but I slightly step back from that just because I do have interest in someone else being the keeper of of the system. I don't have the capacity to be IT for more than one country. you laugh, but like I can't have my phone on silent, because if there is a need in the middle of the night, which is in the day for them, you know, I can't just wait till the next day. And so, yeah, I'm not trying to like give the project to someone else, but I do need help with capacity to expand further, because we need to be able to support added facilities.
Yep. It has happened that your phone has lit up and woken us up the night before an important training ride or race with someone needing your help on getting the electronic record keeping system of Uganda back online.
Yeah.
That is such an insane, like, our lives are so weird, Nico. That's crazy. And I'm over there being grumpy because I'm getting woken up before a hard training ride.
I mean, it is understandable, but it is very, like, the whole... I shouldn't say, I feel like you're going to roll your eyes at me, but I feel like living with you has made me a little softer on these trips. I'm serious. And not like softer in a way that I'm like not hearty, but like, you know, everything is so controlled in your life, right? Like light, you know, just, you know, we have special shades so that, you know, you're not woken up earlier than you want to be. Mm-hmm. And we have white noise. And it's cool. You know, we're able to control the temperature in the room, and there's fans going all the time because there's a certain sound that you like. And, you know, I'm very adaptable. So all these things that you need, I have, you know, grown accustomed to. And then I go to Uganda and I'm like, oh, yeah, like this is actually something that one of the experiences with Sammy that was really funny, because, you know, there are lots of noises and it is very hot when you're sleeping, and
you're in a bug net.
I'm in a bug net, and there's, you know, a loudspeaker with somebody, you know, calling for prayers from the mosque that wake you up at 4:30 in the morning. And I feel like I was a little bit more sensitive to it this year than usual. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, it's because we have this like perfectly controlled environment that you have to sleep in for your work. And, you know, it's just very, it's very different over there.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's so true. And I have absolutely no bashfulness with you talking about that, because it is such a, I think it's really, and it's one of the reasons that I continue to fall in love with traveling more and more, even though it's usually not to a place as different to us as Uganda. But it just gives you such an appreciation for the human experience and how environment is just so such a decider of how you end up living your life. You know, the conversations that I often have because of the circles that I'm in is, you know, I discovered this whatever way to sleep better and recover better between workouts. And it's like you're saying, it's this very specific performance-oriented thing for being better at bike racing. And meanwhile, you're spending time in Uganda having trouble sleeping because it's 82 degrees and you have to sleep in a bug net because of malaria. And, you know, you can't drink the running water.
You wake up with random blindness.
And you might go blind. We didn't even talk about the blindness. Okay.
We've been trying to say goodbye on this podcast.
No, this is good. We have to talk about this. Okay. So this is one of the most stressful periods, and I think one of the most stressful 12 hours in my life happened, and this wasn't even happening to me. And I think you said it was the scariest 12 hours of your life, maybe.
Yes.
Can you...
Like, by far one of the scariest moments of my life.
There were challenges throughout this trip. There's always challenges with going to Uganda, but this might have taken the cake so far. Can you explain what happened?
It definitely took the cake. Well, I still don't know exactly what happened, but there are some theories. And I think in general, when you're working in Uganda, you're on the equator, and you're very sensitive to the sun. You know, it's very easy to get a sunburn when you're there, and you are like you just said about needing to use bug spray and malaria pills and all these things to protect you. But anyway, what happened with my eyes, I had forgotten, and these are theories, if there's an ophthalmologist on here, like we still don't know exactly what happened here. But I think it was a combination of things that happened. And that day I had forgotten my sunglasses at home, and it was also a public holiday. And so I had to walk kind of far to go get lunch, and I had forgotten my sunglasses. So I went out in the heat of the day. To tell you how intense the sun was, that 30 minute walk, I had a pretty severe chest burn from that, but also wasn't wearing sunglasses. And then I was teaching gross dissections with the residents after, and we were dealing with basically the residents were using a new scalpel, and it was a scalpel that had these like disposable blades that they're not used to, and you should take those off when you're done using them and put them in a sharps container. And they did not from the night before. And so it had kind of rusted onto the scalpel holder. And I was attempting to help the residents remove it. And so we had already started a dissection of a uterus, and the blade was really dull, and I was struggling trying to remove the blade. And when I grabbed it with the forceps, it snapped. And when it snapped, it flung formaldehyde and other fluids into my eyes. They didn't burn. It didn't burn at all. In fact, I was not completely sure if the fluid had touched my eyeballs, but I could feel it on my face. And because it wasn't burning and there's no eye wash station there, I just wiped my eyes with my coat and carried on. And so we finished the dissections, and I didn't like that it had happened. And I, we had a good conversation about removing the blades, because my first thought was that this isn't safe for the residents either. And, you know, we're not wearing eye protection. And anyway, as I started to go to bed that night, so many hours later, I felt a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of burning in my eyes. And I remember being like, I was getting on the phone to talk to you to say goodnight. And I just thought about telling you about it. I was just like, yeah, this happened. My eyes are a little burny. And, you know, at that point I had washed my eyes. But you were just like, ah, like, it's okay, Nico. Like, you know, I do tend to get a little paranoid when things out of the ordinary happen. And I had mentioned this. So anyway, I went to bed, and in the middle of the night, my eyes really started burning, like really, really painful burning. And I opened my eyes to see what time it was. And when I opened them, it was dark in the room. So I, you know, couldn't tell at this point that I had lost my vision. But I grabbed my phone and hit the light to see what time it was. And I couldn't see the numbers on the phone. It was too fuzzy. But I could see, you know, light. And so then I panicked and stood up, went into the bathroom, washed my eyes again, and then just realized that I really couldn't see. And so I tried to call you, and I immediately...
Another culture clash. I was in the middle of a...
Intervals.
No, I was in a meeting at Allied looking at renderings of bikes.
Oh, I thought you were... That's crazy. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I tried to call you and you didn't answer. And so I immediately called the next best thing, which is your parents, who Payson's dad is a retired ER physician and often the person that I ask questions to that are medical related. But I had lost, I was not calm. At that point, I was actually crying because I was like, oh my God, I'm like, what am I going to do? Like, how am I going to get home? I'm going to lose. These are the last visions that I, last sights that I'm going to have, or this, you know, blurry room. And it was a really, really scary, scary period. But your dad, after many, many questions, had told me that it just seemed like I had had a UV burn to my eyes. He said it didn't make sense necessarily from the sun, but that, you know, it can happen. Actually, it did happen to a partner of mine on a big adventure in India. He had burnt his cornea and retina from reflections of snow. I've not heard of it in the way that it's happened to me, but I think maybe combination of sun and formaldehyde just, you know, got me. But the really interesting thing about eyes is that the epithelial layer, so outer layer of your eye, will replace itself every 12 to 24 hours. And so within 24 hours, I had most of my vision back, but it was really scary and unbelievably painful. Like, once it started to burn, it just got worse and worse and worse. And then I was crying, which was making it worse. And it was scary times.
Very glad that one was temporary.
Yeah. And it just, you know, that experience has actually been pretty tough on me because, you know, the first thing, like after I calmed down and thought about the situation, like the fact that there's not an eye wash station.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, in talking to my colleagues, many of them have experienced, so, like, Abraham told me that this has happened to him a couple times. And, you know, not really knowing if it's formaldehyde or the sun or what, but these are, you know, this is something that happens. You know, people experience these, like, temporary vision issues. And now I'm, like, thinking about an eye wash station. And, like, how do we... you know, just make the environment more safe for the residents too, you know?
Yep.
It's interesting. It's things that, it's small small changes and things away from the normal laboratory setting that you don't really realize how important they are.
Things we take for granted here.
Yeah.
Glad you're okay, my dear. It's very rare that I fill two pages with notes, but I did this time. And I think we got through all of it.
That's nice.
With the exception, I don't know. I have written in all caps, cash, because one last funny story was how we had to run around town, run around Bentonville and Rogers the day before you left, panicked, trying to find a place that would give us perfect crisp cash from an ATM for you to pay the residents' annual wages. Speaking of weird things you pick up on while over there, somewhere along the way you determined that the best way to pay these residents was in U.S. dollars in cash, and so you take cash with you, but in order for them to exchange it to Ugandan shillings, the cash has to be perfect. It can't have any nicks. It can't have any tiny little, you know, pin marks on it or anything. And we had to, because we're in Bentonville instead of back home in Durango, you've never dealt with this while we're here in Bentonville. You've only dealt with it in Durango.
Where we have a bank.
Where we bank. We don't bank here in Bentonville. And so we weren't able to withdraw the cash in the way that we typically do. And eventually we've just ended up driving around town, finding as many ATMs as we could, maxing out the ATM withdrawal amount, and then going back to this one bank who was very, very sweet and for no fee basically found all of the bills, all of their perfect bills, and exchanged our bills that we got from the ATM with their bills so that you could take this cash to Uganda to pay the residents. So crazy.
It is like it's a very minor thing, but at the time, like the day before I'm leaving. Yeah, it's a lot of time.
It was half a day of sheer stress.
Yeah.
Because you care so much, Nico, and they're relying on, or they're not relying, but they have come to appreciate that support. And they knew you were on your way. you didn't want to, you were putting that pressure on yourself.
Having the cash be usable is important.
Yes, it is.
And yeah, it is a strict process. And I have learned the hard way that if it's not assessed appropriately, it'll get rejected. And then what do you do?
You used to take scary.
We don't need to say how much money I was taking.
I know, but
more than I should have been.
Yes. Another way that Nico was living on the edge.
We're being filmed right now, but I just gave you a very, like, that's a funny thing. Like, I try to talk to you with my eyes, like, stop. And I forgot that we're being filmed. So we're going to, Lily's going to have to feel like Nico's giving.
Anyway. Well, Nico, thank you. I'm so proud of you. I love you so much. And you are the biggest badass I know.
Thank you, Piso. This was fun. It wasn't terrible.
Yes! We're making progress here, too. Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening today. I hope you enjoyed hearing an update from Nicole Baker at long last. I want to say a big thank you to Nicole for helping produce the show each and every week, to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing the show each and every week, and for at least the foreseeable future, to Ledger Bentonville for hosting us for these podcasts. They have, I said one podcast studio at the top of the show, but they actually have multiple. Ledger has just been an awesome new home for us in regards to a workspace. We ride there from our house, just a 5-minute easy ride, and have everything we need to produce this show. Nicole, do her schoolwork, Path of Logic work, me to do all of the business maintenance stuff of my career. And it's just awesome. So if ever you're in Bentonville and need to get some work done, highly recommend you check out Ledger. Also, I want to say thank you to Dometic for supporting today's episode. They have a new discount code for you this year, PAYSON15, for 15% off anything site-wide, drinkware, camp chairs, rooftop tents, whatever you may need for a busy spring and summer of getting outside and enjoying the outdoors can be found at Dometic.com. Be sure to use code PAYSON15 at checkout. Thank you all so much for listening. Next up, we'll be going to Monterey, California for the Sea Otter Classic. We will have a Sea Otter recap episode late next week. Until then, have a good week.